Octopussy by Ian Fleming. Read by Tom Hiddleston.
You know what? Said Major Dexter Smythe to the octopus. You're going to have a real treat today if I can manage it. He had spoken aloud and his breath had steamed up the glass of his Pirelli mask. He put his feet down to the sand beside the niggerhead and stood up. The water reached to his armpits. He took off the mask and spat into it, rubbed the spit round the glass, rinsed it clean, and pulled the rubber band of the mask back over his head. He bent down again. The eye in the mottled brown sack was still watching him carefully from the hole in the coral. But now the tip of a single small tentacle wavered hesitatingly an inch or two out of the shadows, and quested vaguely with its pink suckers uppermost. Dexter Smythe smiled with satisfaction. Given time, perhaps one more month on top of the two during which he'd been chumming up with the octopus, and he would have tamed the darling. But he wasn't going to have that month. Should he take a chance today and reach down and offer his hand instead of the expected lump of raw meat on the end of his spear to the tentacle? Shake it by the hand, so to speak. No, pussy, he thought. I can't quite trust you yet. Almost certainly other tentacles would whip out of the hole and up his arm. He only needed to be dragged down less than 2 feet. The cork valve on his mask would automatically close, and he would be suffocated inside it, or if he tore it off, drowned. He might get in a quick lucky jab with his spear, but it would take more than that to kill pussy. No, perhaps later in the day. It would be rather like playing Russian roulette, and at about the same 5-to-1 odds. It might be a quick, a whimsical way out of his troubles. But not now. It would leave the interesting question unsolved. And he'd promised that nice Professor Bengry at the Institute. Dexter Smythe swam leisurely off towards the reef, his eyes questing for one shape only, the squat, sinister wedge of a scorpionfish. Or, as Bengry would put it, Scorpina plumieri. Major Dexter Smythe, OBE, Royal Marines retired, was the remains of a once brave and resourceful officer, and of a handsome man who had made easy sexual conquests all his military life, and particularly among the Wrens and Racks and ATS who manned the communications and secretariat of the very special task force to which he'd been attached at the end of his service career. Now he was 54, slightly bald, and his belly sagged in the Janssen trunks. And he'd had 2 coronary thromboses. His doctor, Jimmy Greaves, who'd been one of their high poker game at Queen's Club when Dexter Smythe had first come to Jamaica, had half-jocularly described the later one, only a month before, as the second warning. But in his well-chosen clothes, his varicose veins out of sight, and his stomach flattened by a discreet support belt behind an immaculate cummerbund, he was still a fine figure of a man, at a cocktail party or dinner on the North Shore, and it was a mystery to his friends and neighbours why, in defiance of the 2 ounces of whiskey and 10 cigarettes a day to which his doctor had rationed him, he persisted in smoking like a chimney and going to bed drunk, if amiably drunk, every night. The truth of the matter was that Dexter Smythe had arrived at the frontier of the death wish. The origins of this state of mind were many and not all that complex. He was irretrievably tied to Jamaica, and tropical sloth had gradually riddled him so that while outwardly he appeared a piece of fairly solid hardwood, under the varnished surface, the termites of sloth, self-indulgence, guilt over an ancient sin, and general disgust with himself had eroded his once hard core into dust. Since the death of Mary 2 years before, he had loved no one, He wasn't even sure that he had really loved her. But he knew that every hour of the day, he missed her love of him, and her gay, untidy, chiding and often irritating presence. And though he ate their canapés and drank their martinis, he had nothing but contempt for the international riff-raff with whom he consorted on the North Shore. He could perhaps have made friends with the soldier elements, the gentlemen farmers inland, or the plantation owners on the coast, the professional men and the politicians, but that would mean regaining some serious purpose in life, which his sloth, his spiritual acidity, prevented, and cutting down on the bottle, which he was definitely unwilling to do. So Major Smythe was bored, bored to death, and but for one factor in his life, he would long ago have swallowed the bottle of barbiturates he'd easily acquired from a local doctor. The lifeline that kept him clinging to the edge of the cliff was a tenuous one. Heavy drinkers veer towards an exaggeration of their basic temperaments, the classic four: sanguine, phlegmatic, choleric, and melancholic. The sanguine drunk goes gay to the point of hysteria and idiocy. The phlegmatic sinks into a morass of sullen gloom. The choleric is the fighting drunk of the cartoonists, who spends much of his life in prison for smashing people and things, and the melancholic succumbs to self-pity, mawkishness, and tears. Major Smythe was a melancholic, who had slid into a drooling fantasy woven around the birds and insects and fish that inhabited the 5 acres of Wavelets, the name he'd given his small villa is symptomatic, its beach and the coral reef beyond. The fish were his particular favourites. He referred to them as people, and since reef fish stick to their territories as closely as do most small birds, after 2 years he knew them all intimately, loved them, and believed that they loved him in return. They certainly knew him, as the denizens of zoos know their keepers, because he was a daily and regular provider, scraping off algae and stirring up the sand and rocks for the bottom feeders, breaking up sea eggs and urchins for the small carnivores, and bringing out scraps of offal for the larger ones. And now, as he swam slowly and heavily up and down the reef and through the channels that led out to deep water, his people swarmed around him fearlessly and expectantly, darting at the tip of the three-pronged spear they knew only as a prodigal spoon, flirting right up to the glass of the Pirelli, and even, in the case of the fearless, pugnacious demoiselle, nipping softly at his feet and legs. Part of Major Smythe's mind took in all these brilliantly coloured little people, but today he had a job to do, and while he greeted them in unspoken words, "Morning, Beau Gregory," to the dark blue demoiselle sprinkled with bright blue spots, the jewel fish that exactly resembles the starlit fashioning of a bottle of Worth's Vol de Nuit, "Sorry, not today, sweetheart," to a fluttering butterfly fish with false black eyes on its tail, and "You're too fat anyway, blue boy," to an indigo parrot fish that must have weighed a good 10 pounds, his eyes were searching for only one of his people, his only enemy on the reef, the only one he killed on sight, a scorpionfish. Scorpionfish inhabit most of the southern waters of the world, and the rascasse that is the foundation of Bouillabaisse belongs to the family. The West Indian variety runs up to only about 12 inches long and perhaps a pound in weight. It is by far the ugliest fish in the sea, as if nature were giving warning. It is a mottled brownish grey with a heavy, wedge-shaped, shaggy head. It has fleshy, pendulous eyebrows that droop over angry red eyes, and a coloration and broken silhouette that are perfect camouflage on the reef. Though a small fish, its heavily toothed mouth is so wide that it can swallow whole most of the smaller reef fishes. But its supreme weapon lies in its erectile dorsal fins, the first few of which acting on contact like hypodermic needles, are fed by poison glands containing enough tetrodotoxin to kill a man if they merely graze him in a vulnerable spot. In an artery, for instance, or over the heart or in the groin. They constitute the only real danger to the reef swimmer, far more dangerous than barracuda or shark, because, supremely confident in their camouflage and armory, they flee before nothing except the very close approach of a foot or actual contact. Then they flit only a few yards on wide and bizarrely striped pectorals and settle again watchfully either on the sand, where they look like a lump of overgrown coral, or amongst the rocks and seaweed, where they virtually disappear. And Major Smythe was determined to find one, spear it and give it to his octopus to see if it would take or spurn it, see if one of the ocean's great predators would recognize the deadliness of another, know of its poison. Would the octopus consume the belly and leave the spines? Would it eat the lot, and if so, would it suffer from the poison? These were the questions Bengri at the Institute wanted answered. And today, since it was going to be the beginning of the end of Major Smythe's life at Wavelets, and though it might mean the end of his darling octopussy, Major Smythe had decided to find out the answers and leave one tiny memorial to his now futile life in some dusty corner of the Institute's marine biological files. 4. Only a couple of hours earlier, Major Dexter Smythe's already dismal life had changed very much for the worse. So much for the worse that he would be lucky if in a few weeks' time for the sending of cables from Government House to the Colonial Office to be relayed to the Secret Service and thence to Scotland Yard and the Public Prosecutor, and for Major Smythe's transportation to London with a police escort. He got away with a sentence of imprisonment for life. And all this because of a man called Bond, Commander James Bond, who had turned up at 10:30 that morning in a taxi from Kingston. The day had started normally. Major Smythe had awoken from his second sleep, swallowed a couple of Panadols, his heart condition forbade him aspirin, showered and skimped his breakfast under the umbrella-shaped sea almonds and spent an hour feeding the remains of his breakfast to the birds. He then took his prescribed doses of anticoagulant and blood pressure pills and killed time with the daily gleaner until he could have his elevenses, which for some months now he had advanced to 10:30. He had just poured himself the first of two stiff brandies and ginger ales, the drunkard's drink, when he heard the car coming up the drive. Luna, his coloured housekeeper, came out into the garden and announced,
"Jim want to see you, Major."
"What's his name?"
"Him don't see, Major. Him see to tell you him come from Government House."
Major Smythe was wearing nothing but a pair of old khaki shorts and sandals. He said, "All right, Luna. Put him in the living room and say I won't be a moment." And went round the back way into his bedroom and put on a white bush shirt and trousers and brushed his hair. "Government House. Now what the hell?" As soon as he had walked through into the living room and seen the tall man in the dark blue tropical suit standing at the picture window looking out to sea, Major Smythe had somehow sensed bad news. Then, when the man had turned slowly to look at him with watchful, serious, blue-grey eyes, he had known that this was officialdom, and when his cheery smile was not returned, inimical officialdom. A chill had run down Major Smythe's spine. They had somehow found out.
"Well, well, I'm Smythe. I gather you're from Government House. How's Sir Kenneth?"
There was somehow no question of shaking hands. The man said, "I haven't met him. Only arrived a couple of days ago. I went out round the island most of the time. My name's Bond. James Bond. and from the Ministry of Defence. Major Smythe remembered the hoary euphemism for the Secret Service. He said, with forced cheerfulness,
"Oh, the old firm."
The question had been ignored. "Is there somewhere we can talk?"
"Rather, anyway you like. Here or in the garden? What about a drink?"
Major Smythe clinked the ice in the glass he still held in his hand.
"Rum and ginger's the local poison. I prefer the ginger by itself."
The lie came out with the automatic smoothness of the alcoholic. "No thanks. And he would be fine." The man leaned negligently against the wide mahogany windowsill. Major Smythe sat down and threw a jaunty leg over the low arm of one of the comfortable planter's chairs he had had copied from an original by the local cabinet maker. He pulled out the drink coaster from the other arm, took a deep pull at his glass and slid it, with a consciously steady hand, down into the hole in the wood.
"Well,"
he said cheerily, looking the other man straight in the eyes,
"what can I do for you? Has somebody been up to some dirty work on the North Shore and need a spare hand? Be glad to get into the harness again. It's been a long time since those days, but I can still remember some of the old routines."
"Do you mind if I smoke?" The man had already got his cigarette case in his hand. It was a flat gunmetal one that would hold around 50. Somehow this small sign of a shared weakness comforted Major Smythe.
"Of course, my dear fellow."
He made a move to get up, his lighter ready. "It's all right, thanks." James Bond had already lit his cigarette. "No, it's nothing local. I've been sent out to ask you to recall your work for the service at the end of the war." James Bond paused and looked down at Major Smythe carefully. "Particularly the time when you were working with the Miscellaneous Objectives Bureau." Major Smythe laughed sharply. He'd known it. He had known it for absolutely sure. But when it came out of this man's mouth, the laugh had been forced out of Major Smythe like the scream of a hitman.
"Oh, Lord, yes, good old M.O.B. That was a lark, all right."
He laughed again. He felt the anginal pain, brought on by the pressure of what he knew was coming, build up across his chest. He dipped his hand into his trouser pocket, tilted the little bottle into the palm of his hand and slipped the white TNT pill under his tongue. He was amused to see the tension coil up in the other man, the way the eyes narrowed watchfully. "It's all right, my dear fellow. This isn't a death pill." He said,
"You troubled with acidosis?"
"No.
It slays me when I go on a bender. Last night, party at Jamaica Inn. One really ought to stop thinking one's always 25. Anyway, let's get back to MOB Force."
"Not many of us left, I suppose." He felt the pain across his chest withdraw into its lair.
"Something to do with the official history?"
James Bond looked down at the tip of his cigarette. "Not exactly."
"I expect you know I wrote most of the chapter on the force for the war book. It's a long time ago now. Doubt if I'd have much to add today."
"Nothing more about that operation in the Tyrol? Place called Oberaurach? About a mile east of Kitzbühel?" One of the names he had been living with for all these years forced another harsh laugh out of Major Smythe.
"Well, that was a piece of cake. You've never seen such a shambles. All those Gestapo toughs with their doxies, all of them hog-drunk. They'd kept their files all tickety-boo, handed them over without a murmur. Hope that'd earn them easy treatment, I suppose. We gave the staff a first going over and shipped all the bods off to the Munich camp. Last I heard of them. Most of them hang for war crimes, I expect. We handed the bump over to HQ at Salzburg. Then we went on up the Midasil Valley after another hideout."
Major Smythe took a good pull at his drink and lit a cigarette. He looked up. That's the long and the short of it. You were number two at the time, I think. The CEO was an American. A Colonel King from Patton's army. That's right, nice fellow. Wore a moustache, which isn't like an American. Knew his way among the local wines. Quite a civilized chap.
In his report about the operation, he wrote that he handed you all the documents for a preliminary run-through, as you were the German expert with the unit. Then you gave them all back to him with your comments. James Bond paused. Every single one of them?
Major Smythe ignored the innuendo. That's right. Mostly lists of names. Counterintelligence dope. The CI people in Salzburg were very pleased with the stuff. Gave them plenty of new leads. I expect the originals are lying about somewhere. They'll have been used for the Nuremberg trials. Yes, by Jove.
Major Smythe was reminiscent. Pally.
Those were some of the jolliest months of my life. Herring around the country with MOB force. Wine, women and song. And you can say that again.
Here Major Smythe was saying the whole truth. He had had a dangerous and uncomfortable war until 1945. When the commandos were formed in 1941, he had volunteered and been seconded from the Royal Marines to Combined Operations Headquarters under Mountbatten. There his excellent German, his mother had come from Heidelberg, had earned him the unenviable job of being advanced interrogator on commando operations across the Channel. He had been lucky to get away from 2 years of this work unscathed and with the OBE, military, which was sparingly awarded in the last war. And then, in preparation for the defeat of Germany, the Miscellaneous Objectives Bureau had been formed jointly by the Secret Service and Combined Operations, and Major Smythe had been given the temporary rank of Lieutenant Colonel, and told to form a unit whose job would be the cleaning up of Gestapo and Abwehr hideouts when the collapse of Germany came about. The OSS got to hear of the scheme and insisted on getting into the act to cope with the American wing of the front, and the result was the creation of not one but six units that went into operation in Germany and Austria on the day of surrender. They were units of 20 men, each with a light armored car, six jeeps, a wireless truck and three lorries, and they were controlled by a joint Anglo-American headquarters in SHAEF, which also fed them with targets from the Army intelligence units and from the SIS and OSS. Major Smythe had been number two of A Force, which had been allotted the Tyrol, an area full of good hiding places with easy access to Italy and perhaps out of Europe, that was known to have been chosen as funk hole number one by the people MOB Force was after. And, as Major Smythe had just told Bond, they had had themselves a ball. All without firing a shot. Except, that is, two. Fired by Major Smythe. James Bond said casually, "Does the name of Hannes Oberhauser ring a bell?" Major Smythe frowned, trying to remember.
"Can't say it does."
It was 80 degrees in the shade, but he shivered. "Let me refresh your memory. On the same day as those documents were given to you to look over, you made inquiries at the Tiefenbrunner Hotel, where you were billeted, for the best mountain guide in Kitzbühel. You were referred to Oberhauser. The next day you asked your CO for a day's leave, which was granted. Early next morning you went to Oberhauser's chalet, put him under close arrest and drove him away in your jeep. Does that ring a bell?" That phrase about refreshing your memory. How often had Major Smythe himself used it when he was trying to trap a German liar? "Take your time. You've been ready for something like this for years." Major Smythe shook his head doubtfully.
"Can't say it does."
A man with greying hair and a gammy leg spoke some English, as he'd been a ski instructor before the war. Major Smythe looked candidly into the cold, clear eyes.
Sorry, can't help you.
James Bond took a small blue leather notebook out of his inside pocket and turned the leaves. He stopped turning them. He looked up. At that time, as sidearms, you were carrying a regulation Webley & Scott .45 with the serial number 8967362.
It was certainly a Webley. A damned clumsy weapon. Hope they've got something more like the Luger or the Heavy Beretta these days. But I can't say I ever took a note of the number.
The number's right enough, said James Bond. I've got the date of its issue to you by HQ, and the date when you turned it in. You signed the book both times. Major Smythe shrugged.
Well, then, it must have been my gun. But,
he put rather angry impatience into his voice,
what, if I may ask, is all this in aid of?
James Bond looked at him almost with curiosity. He said, and now his voice was not unkind, you know what it's all about, Smythe. He paused and seemed to reflect. Tell you what, I'll go out into the garden for 10 minutes or so. Give you time to think things over. Give me a hail. He added seriously, it'll make things so much easier for you if you come out with the story in your own words. He walked to the door into the garden. He turned round. I'm afraid it's only a question of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. You see, I had a talk with the Foo brothers in Kingston yesterday. He stepped out onto the lawn. Something in Major Smythe was relieved. Now at least the battle of wits, the trying to invent alibis, the evasions, were over. If this man Bond had got to the Foos, to either of them, they would have spilled the beans. The last thing they wanted was to get in bad with the government. And anyway, there was only about 6 inches of the stuff left. Major Smythe got briskly to his feet, went to the loaded sideboard and poured himself out another brandy and ginger ale, almost 50-50.
He might as well live it up, while there was still time.
The future wouldn't hold many more of these for him. He went back to his chair and lit his 20th cigarette of the day. He looked at his watch. It said 11:30. If he could be rid of the chap in an hour, he'd have plenty of time with his people. He sat and drank and marshalled his thoughts. He could make the story long or short. Put in the weather and the way the flowers and pines had smelled on the mountain. Or he could cut it short. He would cut it short.
Up in that big double bedroom in the Tiefenbrunner, with the wads of buff and grey paper spread out on the spare bed, he hadn't been looking for anything special, just taking samples here and there and concentrating on the ones marked in red. Kommandosache, Hust Vertraulich.
There weren't many of these, and they were mostly confidential reports on German top brass, intercepts of broken Allied ciphers and the whereabouts of secret dumps. Since these were the main targets of A-Force, Major Smythe had scanned them with particular excitement. Food, explosives, guns, espionage records, files of Gestapo personnel. A tremendous haul. And then, at the bottom of the packet, there had been the single envelope sealed with red wax and the notation, only to be opened in final emergency. The envelope contained one single sheet of paper. It was unsigned, and the few words were written in red ink. The heading said, Valuta, and beneath was written, Wilde Kaiser, Franziskaner Halt, 100 meters, Östlich Steinhügel, Waffenkiste, 2 bar, 24 carat, and then a list of measurements in centimeters. Major Smythe held his hands apart, as if telling a story about a fish he had caught. Each bar would be nearly as big as a couple of bricks, and one single English sovereign of only 18 carat was selling nowadays for £2 to £3. This was a bloody fortune. 40, 50,000 pounds worth, maybe even 100. He had no idea, but quite coolly and speedily, in case anyone should come in, he put a match to the paper in the envelope, ground the ashes to powder, and swilled them down the lavatory. Then he took out his large-scale Austrian ordnance map of the area, and in a moment had his finger on the Franziskaner Halt. It was marked as an uninhabited mountaineer's refuge, on a saddle just below the highest of the easterly peaks of the Kaiser Mountains, that awe-inspiring range of giant stone teeth that give Kitzbühel its threatening northern horizon. And the cairn of stones would be about there, his fingernail pointed. And the whole bloody lot was only 10 miles and perhaps a 5 hours' climb away. The beginning had been as this fellow Bond had described. He had gone to Oberhauser's chalet at 4 in the morning, had arrested him, and had told his weeping, protesting family that he, Smythe, was taking him to an interrogation camp in Munich. If the guide's record was clean, he would be back home within a week. If the family kicked up a fuss, it would only make trouble for Oberhauser. Smythe had refused to give his name, and had had the forethought to shroud the numbers on his jeep. In 24 hours, A Force would be on its way, and by the time military government got to Kitzbühel, the incident would already be buried under the morass of the occupation tangle. Oberhauser had been a nice enough chap once he had recovered from his fright, and when Smythe talked knowingly about skiing and climbing, both of which he had done before the war, the pair, as Smythe intended, became quite pally. Their route lay along the bottom of the Kaiser Range to Kufstein, and Smythe drove slowly, making admiring comments on the peaks that were now flushed with the pink of dawn. Finally, below the Peak of Gold, as he called it to himself, he slowed to a halt and pulled off the road into a grassy glade. He turned in his seat and said candidly, "Oberhauser, you are a man after my own heart. We share many interests together, and from your talk and from the man I think you to be, I'm sure you did not cooperate with the Nazis. Now, I will tell you what I will do. We will spend the day climbing on the Kaiser, and I will then drive you back to Kitzbühel and report to my commanding officer that you've been cleared at Munich." He grinned cheerfully. "Now, how about that?" The man had been near to tears of gratitude. But could he have some kind of paper to show that he was a good citizen? Certainly. Major Smythe's signature would be quite enough. The pact was made. The jeep was driven up a track and well hidden from the road, and they were off at a steady pace, climbing up through the pine-scented foothills. Smythe was well-dressed for the climb. He had nothing on under his bush jacket, shorts, and a pair of the excellent rubber-soled boots issued to American parachutists. His only burden was the Weblian Scott, and tactfully, for Oberhauser was, after all, one of the enemy, Oberhauser didn't suggest that he leave it behind some conspicuous rock. Oberhauser was in his best suit and boots, but that didn't seem to bother him, and he assured Major Smythe that ropes and petars would not be needed for their climb, and that there was a hut directly up above them where they could rest. It was called the Franziskaner Halt. "Is it indeed?" said Major Smythe.
"Yes, and below it there is a small glacier, very pretty, but we will climb around it. There are many crevasses."
"Is that so?" said Major Smythe thoughtfully. He examined the back of Oberhauser's head, now beaded with sweat.
After all, he was only a bloody kraut. Or at any rate, of that ilk. What would one more or less matter? It was all going to be as easy as falling off a log. The only thing that worried Major Smythe was getting the bloody stuff down the mountain. He decided that he would somehow sling the bars across his back. After all, he could slide it most of the way, in its ammunition box or whatnot. It was a long, dreary hack up the mountain, and when they were above the tree line, the sun came up, and it was very hot. And now it was all rock and scree, and their long zigzag sent boulders and rubble rumbling and crashing down the slope that got ever steeper as they approached the final crag, grey and menacing, that lanced away into the blue above them. They were both naked to the waist and sweating, so that the sweat ran down their legs into their boots. But despite Oberhauser's limp, they kept up a good pace, and when they stopped for a drink and a swab down at a hurtling mountain stream, Oberhauser congratulated Major Smythe on his fitness. Major Smythe, his mind full of dreams, said curtly and untruthfully that all English soldiers were fit, and they went on. The rock face wasn't difficult. Major Smythe had known that it wouldn't be, or the climber's hut couldn't have been built on the shoulder. Toe holds had been cut in the face, and there were occasional iron pegs hammered into crevices. But he couldn't have found the more difficult traverses alone, and he congratulated himself on deciding to bring a guide. Once, Oberhauser's hand, testing for a grip, dislodged a great slab of rock, loosened by years of snow and frost, and sent it crashing down the mountain. Major Smythe suddenly thought about noise. "Many people around here?" he asked as they watched the boulder hurtle down into the tree line. "Not a soul until you get near Kufstein," said Oberhauser. He gestured along the arid range of high peaks. "No grazing, little water. Only the climbers come here, and since the beginning of the war..." He left the phrase unfinished. They skirted the blue-fanged glacier below the final climb to the shoulder. Major Smythe's careful eyes took in the width and depth of the crevasses. Yes, they would fit. Directly above them, perhaps 100 feet up under the lee of the shoulder, were the weather-beaten boards of the hut. Major Smythe measured the angle of the slope. Yes, it was almost a straight dive down. Now or later? He guessed later. The line of the last traverse wasn't very clear. They were up at the hut in 5 hours flat. Major Smythe said he wanted to relieve himself, and wandered casually along the shoulder to the east, paying no heed to the beautiful panoramas of Austria and Bavaria that stretched away on either side of him, perhaps 50 miles into the heat haze. He counted his paces carefully. At exactly 120, there was the cairn of stones. A loving memorial, perhaps, to some long-dead climber. Major Smythe, knowing differently, longed to tear it apart there and then. Instead, he took out his Webley and Scott, squinted down the barrel, and twirled the cylinder. Then he walked back.